Radio Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
First day of June 2023, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is indeed the O'Chelly Effect, the show you were looking for. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me say what I'm saying. Most of you will catch it further on down the stream via your final cyber of choice, your applicable application, your podcatcher du jour. We well know this, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are. Welcome to it. Anyways, Thursday, and it's been unusual lately for me to have both Mike Swanson and Larry Hancock on the same show, and even though I went late to air here on the live stream, you podcatcher people, you podcast listeners out there aren't going to care. I've got both Mike Swanson, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, be in the know, go to WallStreetWindow.com, it's not just about Wall Street, but also the author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War, which is a book in a series on that particular conflict. The other two projected, it's supposed to be three books, the other two projected have not been released yet. I think Mike's working on them. But we might have to delve into said subject tonight, a touch, maybe, or maybe not. Going to be, spoiler by the way, going to be some JFK stuff coming up in both hours. Why? Second hour author Larry Hancock is with us, and although I have some interesting thoughts on UAP stuff that he should be talking about very, very soon, tonight we're going to focus in the second hour of the show, or the second, probably the third segment, will be Lee Harvey Oswald and the reframing of, and not trying to frame him as in for a crime, but the reframing of the portrait, so to speak, of the individual of historical interest known as Lee Harvey Oswald. So Larry Hancock will be with us in the second hour, definitely, and in the third segment, I believe. But Mike Swanson is with us live as we go. And again, happy to have you along. And little pause again last week, Mike. You were away, but boy, am I happy to have you back. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. It's good to talk with you today.
Yeah, and you know, I was going to talk to you a little bit about local news stuff and so on and so forth. But why stress on that? You and I have lots of personal interests in history and all that good stuff. Oh, by the way, speaking of history and our personal interests, just a really quick thing about the website and the swag bag packages that will be going out. If you would like, after 10 p.m. tonight, I'm going to, you the listener, not you, Mike, you the listener, although, Mike, you could if you felt like it, if you're hanging around after 10 p.m. tonight and want to be part of the O'Chelly.com promo video that I'm going to make, which is about 2 or 3 minutes long. If you want to participate in that, get in contact with me and let me know, you the listeners, if you hear this live. Contact me, charles.ocelli on Skype, or write to blindjfkresearcher@gmail.com. Do one of those two things, and you, any listener who wants to and has use of Skype, could participate in the making of a short promo video tonight, sometime after 10 p.m., because I want to promote the swag bag stuff, which is not on sale in any way, shape, or form. It's stuff being offered to you as thank you gifts for supporters. You out there choose to support us. At $50 or more, you get to choose a hat with the O'Chelly.com show on it that you would like. Currently, that's only 4 shows. But each one of these hats are all in very short runs and quite unique. The most of them that might be made in exactly the same form in this run, there might be 3 or 4 of them that are the same. They're mostly 1 and 2 of a kind, and you can get an O'Chelly.com shirt, hat. You might get shirts, though, too, because the random swag bag comes up later. But back to the hats. O'Chelly.com, O'Chelly Effect hat, Age of Transitions hat, Uncle the Podcast hat, or Get Mad with Chris Graves hat. These things you can choose from. The rest of your swag bag I'm going to assemble, and you may or may not get a bag in with that too. Bunch of stuff, but we'll talk about it later, much more, because again, I'm making Mike Swanson wait, and I've already killed about 5 minutes of podcast time. So Mike, I did ask you how you're doing already, but what is on your mind this evening, sir?
Well, I'm going to make a connection with local stuff and history. I'm starting, you know, to do more writing, mm-hmm. and it is part of that. Thinking about how to write, you know, because I'm writing a follow-up to the last book I did about the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. But it's really going to be about the Kennedy administration and covert action and all sorts of different topics in one book.
Which at different points you get different perspectives because you know a lot more today. Even if you were fully studied up on it, say, 10 or 15 years ago, there's been more information that has come to light since then. So you have to update it, and you are doing that as you well do. And by the way, Mike has authored more books than I ever mention on here. But and one of them is very relevant to this conversation, considering that you're from Virginia there. And you wrote a book about the history of Danville, indeed. You've also taken the time to release a writing by your dad where you wrote a foreword about the Roman Empire. Generally speaking, you're interested in history altogether, but local history is one of those things that is extremely useful, especially when somebody's trying to develop context and figure out things that were going on. When somebody looks at the microcosm of their local situation and historical reality, it's always relevant and fascinating. So you have actually done that. You've written on global geopolitical issues for sure. You've written about Kennedy before, although you haven't had a full book dedicated to it. And this book about the first book about the Vietnam conflict is very interesting. Why? And I wonder how that's going to go in the second volume. I'm actually anxious to see how that's going to go. But all these things are interconnected and make sense, especially because you're the kind of writer that you are. And as I've tried to explain to people, if you haven't read Mike's writing, the long form stuff, I advise it because quite often what Mike is extremely adept at doing is taking very complex historical realities that require some nuance, that require you know, a bit of a detailed study and seem to be overwhelming to some people when it comes to details and stuff. And quite frankly, Mike communicates a lot of complex ideas and situations in a very attainable and, easily understood way. Yeah, go ahead. I'm just complimenting your writing.
Let me put
you
this way. Yeah. Like, the topic, though, that you know, that's common on your show that we're all, you know, share a lot of interest in, and Larry will be talking about it some way or another afterwards, mm-hmm. is really the national security state and, you know, the history of that in the United States. I mean, it's the Vietnam War. That's touches on the Kennedy assassination. It
right.
touches on UFOs.
And
all
as,
sorts of.
And as with you, right, Larry has covered this stuff contextually all over the map. I mean, when you take a look at books like Surprise Attack and, what's the other one there? There's two very, very good ones, but Surprise Attack is one. He talks about the behavior of the interesting situations involving and so on and so forth, where Larry, his subgenre in and of itself would be the behavior of the national security state under different circumstances, right? I mean, that's just what he does.
Yeah,
oh, Shadow Warfare.
Book,
Shadow
Surprise
Warfare is the other
Attack
book.
Surprise Attack is great. His books, he's one of the best writers on this stuff. The thing is, this topic isn't just covered in books. You know, you got movies, you know, a whole list of movies, not just the JFK movie, but you can go back to the President's Men, Days in the Condor,
right.
Zero Dark Thirty.
13,
James Bond, for that matter.
Yeah, what was it? 13 Days. Yeah. You could talk about executive action. You could talk about, you know, one of my favorite ones was a movie called Deterrence, believe it or not, which was, you know, a dramatization, but it was Kevin Pollak was the president. Really weird sort of circumstance. He ends up in a diner. You ever see this one? And he chooses
no,
to.
Uh-huh.
Oh, well, yeah, take a look at it. It's really an underrated kind of weird thing. Kevin Pollak is the president. And an accidental nuclear strike occurs in Russia, common theme in some other movies, right, where, you know, they then make a trade-off. And deterrence, what did we do to deter the greater nuclear conflict? And you and I have discussed the day after. You know, whether it's a dramatization, a historical dramatization, or just a sort of, you know, taking a dip into the zeitgeist of a particular time period and dramatizing that, or it's a documentary. Many different film entries have been made. I mean, even going all the way to, you know, your average YouTuber or whatever who got serious about history, all the way to Hollywood productions and many, many different stops in between. So, I mean, there's a great deal of media out there available for people to learn, not just books, but audio presentations, video presentations. I mean, hell, my podcast, if you look at it from one point of view, a lot of social, historical, and even current events as they're unfolding have been memorialized in my podcast over the years. One could say that you could take a dance through at least 20th century history a lot through my show. Although I've gone outside of the 20th century and the 21st century too, one could say that there's a collection of media there where people could learn something. So it's all great and it's all good, but you actually write historical nonfiction, and you participate, you know, clearly through Wall Street Window and stuff in a way of memorializing various events that are unfolding currently. Always with an eye on history, though, because obviously it's like, what can we learn from it? What can we determine will be the future of things based on the history? So all of this stuff is great context and necessary, in my mind, for somebody to be well-educated and aware of what's going on in the world. And Larry is again, one of my favorite authors as well. So, you know, a little bit of bias there on my part. But so are you, Mike. I appreciate your style. And the information that you do work very hard at presenting to people so that they can be educated about previously unknown stuff a lot of times. I mean, there's documents in the Why the Vietnam War book and references to things that I don't think are really out there generally to the public that are sort of rarefied in their presentation, or am I wrong about that?
No, there's new information in that book for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying every page of the book is new, but people who read it, they'll find definitely in the last couple chapters, there's a lot of new information. But I've been reading, or I read a book several years ago. It's called The Secret War, Treason, Espionage in Modern Fiction. Mm. And it's an academic book that's studying this topic in literature and in movies going back.
Right. And let's not confuse it with The Secret Team, by the way, which somebody might have missed. Yeah. It's, you know, The Secret Team, the Prouty book and all that.
This is The Secret War. This is a book about the genre itself, going back to Rudyard Kipling, T. Lawrence, up to Steven Spielberg, and so forth.
Okay, so as opposed to a book about history, this is a history book of the history. So this is what we call historiography, I believe. Yeah?
Yeah, or literature. It's analyzing the literature of it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you know, it's the different forms of how this topic is tackled. And like, for example, the Kennedy assassination, I would say the two best books written about it are the James Douglas book and then the Don DeLillo book, Libra, which is a novel. You know,
right.
I would actually tell people that novel might be closer to what happened on the ground, and not that it's a factual book hardly at all, but as a metaphor or something, maybe closer to what actually happened than any work of nonfiction about the assassination has been written. What that book does, this novel, is it doesn't purport. And I only read it once, you know, years ago, but it doesn't purport to like solve it. It tries to kind of put you in the shoes of some characters that were involved in manipulating Oswald, and then the assassination goes off without them, you know, having been in on it. Mm-hmm. That's one of the plots of the novel. I wouldn't be shocked if that happened, that there are people that knew of Oswald or knew of some of the aspects surrounding the assassination who were shocked when the event itself actually took place. But I picked this book up again, in read one chapter in it where she talks about some author I've never read that, you know, wrote these novels and asserted in his novels that they, that history itself, when I was in community college, I had a history course and the professor said, well, you take the word history and it says his story, it's a story. And, you know, that's how we understand history is through narratives and so forth. And then when I went to college, in a graduate program in history, the professors were asserting at that time that history, that these stories aren't all necessarily true. You can't really know 100% what happened, and that's kind of self-evident.
Right.
But this idea that I countered rereading this book, The Secret War, that's mentioned here, is that this person said that history is a story that we're told, but what really drives history are secret betrayals that the person, you know, reading the history book or let's say today watching a movie really rarely know anything about at all. And if we do know there was a betrayal, it's like the Kennedy assassination. We know something happened, but, you know, we don't really know the full details of it.
Okay.
But the author was making out like these are personal betrayals that take place, that are driving historical events. And the thing about it is locally, I'm not going to bore everyone with the details, or it's not really that important, but a couple weeks ago I was involved in I went to an event. It was a nomination locally for candidates to the who would be endorsed by the local Republican Party, and you know, I know a lot what happened in the event. You know, I was sort of working with some of these candidates, and there was a betrayal that happened and machinations that happened that helped to generate the winners of this event. And then the newspaper reported on it a couple days later, and no one who read the article would have any clue of what really took place at all.
Right.
And, you know, even the us that went and some of the candidates had to take a couple days to figure it all out. And the candidates had to talk to each other to understand what happened. The point of that is this, you know, there's a lot of things that happen. You know, I guess it's a funny feeling, you know, to know the details of something and then pick up a newspaper and read a story that is basically fiction.
Mm. Right.
So it's like, how much of everything is that? You know, everything we read, is how much of it is the same? It's really more going on than we got any clue of. And then we look at history, something that happened so long ago. I throw another example out. A couple months ago, I read a book about I'm not sure how old it was, a couple years old, but it's supposed to be the newest, best book about World War II and Hitler. And I'd read probably five or six, you know, World War II Hitler books. I know me and you have talked about The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which was a big hit in the 1950s.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, this new book I read had, you know, a lot of interesting information in it that made me think of some of the things we've been told about Hitler differently. For example, you know, the stereotype of Hitler is that he was nuts and tried to take over the world, and he was crazy to even think he could fight, you know, the United States and Britain and the Soviet Union and the whole world all at once. Well, when I read this, I understand that actually what he was doing came close to working, and because he wasn't trying to take on the whole world all at once. What he was hoping to do was invade the Soviet Union and win before the United States could be ready and kind of have a fait accompli, like I've won, and now what are you going to do? You know, and then negotiate with England some sort of settlement. That's really what his goal was, and I already knew that when he invaded the Soviet Union, the first couple months of that war, the United States intelligence people actually thought he was going to win because he was rapidly advancing on the battlefield, and it wasn't like 6 months or so later that he was slowed down when the wintertime came, and then it became clear, according to this book, it's pretty convincing, that once his assault was slowed down and stopped at Moscow, that the Germans pretty much knew they were going to lose. Mm. And he was just, you know, even he knew it. And it's from that point on that he started to physically deteriorate. But he, you know, had to keep on doing what he was doing. Then everyone kept obeying him, basically. around him, but anyway, that's the point. Is that's a new interpretation to me of part of World War II that I never had heard of before, and it's pretty convincing. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot different than the stereotype of, well, this guy's just crazy. You know, if I look at the pattern of his career and what he was actually, from the way he started to that moment, he was basically being super aggressive in whatever he was doing and doubling down like someone betting at blackjack or something until he went bust, basically. Yeah, you know, but maybe that's crazy. I mean, but maybe it's crazy to want to be a world leader anyway. But
well, a lot of leaders that have been of consequence, who have conquered a great deal of land or have achieved, you know, unifying countries, whatever. Quite often, I mean, there are large gambles here. If you were betting with the odds all the time and your movements, would Italy have been unified? Would this or that or the third thing have been turned into a nation state when it was something else? You know what I'm saying? So there's always, there's always a gamble, so to speak, when it comes to these kinds of things. And one could say, look, what is it? What is the old saying, right? Fortune favors the bold, etc. Again, I'm not making any moral judgments here. What I'm saying is that if you're going to do something of massive significance like that, it does require some risk taking. Yeah?
As far as World War II history, mm-hmm. One thing that helped me understand or has influenced my thinking in regards to the national security state in the United States is I read a couple books, you know, this is probably 10 years ago now, about the Holocaust, mm-hmm. and how it was organized and how it happened and so forth. And there's two basic historical arguments for why it happened. The one is that the Germans were simply, I buy the second one, so I'm telling you the one I don't really believe. But the first one is basically that the German people were basically more anti-Semitic than anyone else in the world, more evil, you could almost say. And their ideology and hatred, mm-hmm. was what drove them to do it, you know. And it, you know, it'd be easy to find evidence of someone's being hateful. In fact, a couple months ago, I watched I think it's called, I watched this movie that's a Nazi propaganda movie about Jewish people. And this movie is censored. You really, in order to watch it, you have to go, it's illegal to watch it in Germany. In order to watch it, you have to go to a video website and type in your information. You know, you got to give them your name and stuff. I mean, I don't know any movie like that.
Well, Germany, Germany has some very strict laws about the dissemination of information.
I mean, Americans have to do that. We have to do it.
Well, no, but that's the thing.
YouTube. It's a.
Yeah, but
if you just type top German, you know, go to Google, Wikipedia or something, and get a list of the German propaganda films.
My point is that the intellectual properties that are registered in Germany, though, what I'm trying to say here, is that because they're an intellectual property registered in Germany, they have done their level best to suppress access to anything that makes the German nation appear to be on board, because at one time they were. National policy was like that, so anything that is in support of maybe, you know, the Holocaust wasn't such a bad thing kind of deal, they don't want that disseminated if they can help it. Because they would really like to sanitize
about,
that.
The thing about the movie, mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds terrible to say this when I say this, but this movie, I would say this, that historical argument that I'd dismiss in favor of the second one, which I'll give in a second. But this movie is probably the best evidence for that historical argument, because if you watch the movie, which I watched the movie, it is convincing propaganda. That I'm not saying it's true, but it's an effective piece of propaganda, because the way it ends, the last couple scenes, they show and I don't even know this is true, you know, but they show a bunch of Jewish people killing animals.
There's a whole history to this where they got, you know, the best German filmmakers of the day. And even when they conquered territories, they took other filmmakers from conquered territories and literally employed them to make these films. The most famous example everybody knows about, and they can't suppress, is the whole presentation of the Olympic Games, right? What was that? Leni Riefenstahl, I think was her name, was apparently this woman director in Germany who was, you know, excellent at creating imagery.
Steven Spielberg produced one film that... It was a Nazi propaganda film of the ghettos, trying to make the people look like they're so downtrodden, that they're subhuman and basically deserve to die. That's what they're trying to argue in this propaganda movie. It's not really, doesn't make me feel like that when I watch it.
Steven Spielberg made a film that is a Nazi propaganda film, you're saying?
No, yeah. He took an old Nazi propaganda film and released it.
Oh, he released it. He didn't make it. There's a timeline problem here.
An old Nazi propaganda film,
right?
That they did. It's Nazis filming the ghetto.
I understand.
And showing how bad off everyone is.
Okay.
And released that, and then he's got like commentary afterwards. I mean, you can watch that. Mm-hmm. But why am I bringing that up? It's just a piece of German propaganda.
Right.
But the film that I watched, I think it's called The Eternal Jew or something like this.
Right. You know? Yeah.
but it's the way, the end scene, one of the end, one of the second end scene of it is a bunch of Jewish people killing, I think they're cows, killing these animals, but they're torturing them. You know, they're stabbing them and letting them bleed to death, and the animals are suffering. They're making you watch this over the course of several minutes.
Right. I get what they're doing. What they've done is they've taken the kosher slaughter process and they're showing it to people, because kosher slaughtering is you got to like literally slit the animal's throat and you hang them upside down and this. You can't kill them in the regular mechanized slaughterhouse way, in order for them to get the blessing to be a kosher, piece of beef, right? So what they did is they took a film like that and repurposed it, and, you know, they shoot it and show the ugliest possible side of that. I assure you, if you go to look at a slaughterhouse anywhere, you're not gonna feel too good about the treatment of animals, you might not want to eat steak for a couple of weeks, depending on who you are. But what they did is they took a piece of film like that and they made it into a propaganda thing. So Spielberg re-released this in order to show people.
No. So this wasn't in the Spielberg movie. This is the one I watched. You know.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got confused.
You confused talking about two different things.
Sorry.
But this is the thing I'm telling you was effective propaganda.
Right.
This I don't remember what the name of the Spielberg thing is. But this scene was in this movie that you really can't find on the internet.
Right.
It's like in one spot, you gotta give them your information to watch it. You know, they want to know who watches it.
Well, that's okay. It's very, very difficult to, apparently to find, a film that is allegedly Beverly Oliver in a stag film too. You can only go to one website. But anyway, yeah. jokes, folks.
So there's a scene where they're making these animals suffer. And what that does is it makes you, you know, you don't want to see people harming animals in that way. The narrator then is telling you how terrible they are to torture animals and making the animals suffer. And the implication that they then make is that, well, you know, we're not like that. We're going to stop the suffering of these animals are doing,
right.
And we're not going to make the Jewish people suffer. We'll kill them in an easy, humane manner.
Lovely.
That's the implication that you get.
Well,
what they're saying.
And this is very typical. Yes, very this is very typical. This is what you and I have talked about several times regarding the dehumanization of the enemy. One way or another, where you make them appear to, whether it's true or not, you make them appear in the worst possible light, you dehumanize them, you take away, you make them appear to be doing the ugliest and most terrible things possible in order so that you can justify your treatment of them, right? The dehumanization.
Yeah, well, that's what they do. And then, you know, the whole thing you've been watching, I think it's an hour long, the whole thing is how terrible these people are and this and that, and you don't, you know, it's so overblown.
Right, but that's what the narrator tells you.
But then they show that scene is the most convincing scene. I mean,
look at these people, the way they treat poor animals. Look at what they do. Look at how terrible they are, heartless they are.
And
meanwhile,
And then the movie ends with one final scene after that, which is Adolf Hitler in the Reichstag, declaring that if there's a world war, he's going to do the ultimate solution, you know, against Jewish people.
He's going to fix this. What they do is they show you the darker frames of this other film where these people appear to be darker and a bit more, you know, nefarious, just even in lighting. They'll change the lighting and the composition of the film.
Oh, yeah, all that.
And then
that.
What you do is you present the hero Hitler.
In Nazi Germany. And anyone who watched this movie, you know, sees the end scene and Hitler is saying he's going to kill them all.
Well, not only is he going to kill them all, but
gave the Reichstag. Everyone in Germany knew these people, you know, somewhere or another.
So what he does is he comes on and he looks clean and pressed and he's well dressed and he looks way more civilized and he says, look, we're going to solve this problem. And, again, that was part of it, along with the filming of the Olympics, where they were supposed to be showing the superiority of the German athlete and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's all about celebrate us, and also we are justified in whatever terrible acts we do, because look at how terrible these people are. And, again, this is very common. This is not something that is unused by, the good, the bad, or the ugly when it comes to conflicts of all types.
Right.
But, yeah, of course, go ahead.
Now, So what I've just presented is evidence that the Germans were diabolically racist and driven into that through the propaganda. And I mean, you can watch it and see, you know. Now, that's the argument that's been made for why the Holocaust has happened since the Holocaust has been revealed. In fact, there's a whole argument that either the American propaganda, and you can watch Why We Fight. You know, well, I've watched the first two of that. It depicts the Germans, the Japanese, and the Italians as just diabolically evil.
Oh yeah, and they're savage. They're savages. Yeah. They're subhuman. Right. You know, and so on and so forth. I mean, everything from cartoons on to regular films were meant to depict the enemy in a less than human way. You know, they're either idiots or they're savage or they're like Cro-Magnon men. You know, what were the Germans? They were Huns, right?
That's World War One.
That's World War One. I'm just saying these are common.
I recommend watching another movie, and that's called The Wannsee Conference. And there's two versions of it. One was put out, I believe, by an Israeli filmmaker in the 70s or 1980 or so. Then another one is on HBO. It might have been retitled. But so with the Holocaust, there was a famous meeting at this place called Wannsee. It was a a fancy living quarters, like a mansion. In Austria or somewhere. But anyway, they had been killing people, shooting people on a mass scale. And then at this conference, the decision was made to use gas.
Well, right. This was the point at which there were evaluations made, and I've seen a dramatization of this. The HBO one was very well done, actually.
Yeah, you see what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, so where they do. For the listener, Mike, let me help out the listener a little bit, is that this is a dramatization that I saw on HBO of this conference where, you know, they're sitting there saying, look, we're rounding people up, we're shooting them, we're drowning them, but it's not very efficient. And apparently there's historical documentation to back up a lot of this where they say, look, it's just not efficient. It's not working out well. We're wasting bullets and time and manpower. We can do it in a much more efficient, mechanized way, which is allegedly where this concept of the final solution gets born. And it's a weird thing because even now today we have propaganda going in the other direction, where, look, you know, Jewish people are part of our culture and they need to be recognized as such and so on and so forth. I don't know if you saw it, but there was, like, you know, Jewish Heritage Month. I forget if it's May or June because I just saw it the other day and it's on the cusp of the change of the month, right? Where, you know, that is now a propaganda out there to reverse the negative stereotypes, et cetera, which are part of what goes on. But again, you got propaganda pushes for various reasons. What's interesting here is we're going to transition into talking about something else very soon. So I want to let you get out your final thoughts on this portion of it. We'll take a little break. And then we're going to spend the last little bit of the hour on something else.
The point I'm trying to make is that if you watch this Wannsee conference thing, what you see is how it's planned out. And the people that are planning it out, they're basically a bunch of bureaucrats. They're not fanatical, foaming at the mouth. Most of them, one or two were, but most of them are just regular bureaucrats. In fact, two people I want to point out that were there, one was the head of the Gestapo, not the SS, but the Gestapo, that, like, the police. And this guy, before Hitler took power, had the same basic position. He's head of the state secret police of Germany before Hitler took power, and he was against the Nazis. He was spying, you know, he had his people watching and spying on Nazis. And then when Hitler took power, he just kept doing it for them. You know, he just kept the same position and he was one of the most important people inside their security state. And so here is a guy that's not an ideological Nazi, but is just this, like, J. Edgar Hoover type or something, just some bureaucrat that goes along and just, you know, has his position and, you know, is very, you know, he plays a big role in the mecha, the carrying out of the Holocaust. Another guy was like a judge who was one of the top judges, you know, he invented the Nuremberg Code that was used to discriminate against Jewish people and remove them basically from civil society before the war started. And he attends this conference and he basically says, I don't want to do this. This is too extreme. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do it. And they just, that's all right. He just doesn't do anything. The point of that is that that shows that in many cases, the Germans had a choice that were involved in this stuff, whether to do it or not. You know, they had, it's the idea that they all had to follow orders is.
Well, there's a yes and no to that, that some resistance was there, but once the, you know, just like anything else that we've discussed about political, situations and the sort of gravity or the inertia, if you will, of the bureaucratic system, in some cases, once momentum gets moving in a certain direction, I mean, there's nothing somebody who's within that system can do.
Well, I mean, this guy couldn't stop it.
It's not like he'd be able to stop it. He might have been able to withdraw from it, but see, there might have been consequences.
Yeah, he couldn't stop it.
Yeah. But there might have been consequences. Well, wait a sec, Mike. There might have been consequences to that. And it is very interesting. We're going to skip the break and go straight to Larry in the next hour. But okay. There are consequences that might have come along with that that maybe aren't revealed. What is interesting, though, is that during that dramatization, you could clearly recognize that there were people that really looked at it as just a bureaucratic issue. I mean, they were sorting out people like they were sorting out, you know, paperwork. Oh, well, I guess we'll make it, you know, we'll staple it together every 10 pages. We'll just stop using bullets and we'll use gas. It'll be more efficient. It'll save money. I mean, there were people looking at it as cold as that. There were others that were fanatical. There were others that were maybe going, man, I don't know if this is a great idea. You know, glory of Germany, but we need to do this. It just shows that everything wasn't homogenous. It wasn't completely just, you know, an entire nation of bloodthirsty people. There were various directions that some people looked at it from, you know. And look, I'm not going to argue the guilt or whatever of individuals, depending on the different tiers they may have been involved here. But what I am saying is that there is a nuance that one needs to recognize, that it wasn't necessarily just, you know, like a lot of History Channel presentations, look at the evil that was an entire nation. Well, maybe not an entire nation. I'm not trying to make excuses or anything. What I'm saying is that you can't always assume that everybody in any way is 100% on board with anything once you start adding people to the equation, right? I mean, it's difficult to get five people in a room to agree on what type of pizza to order, Mike. You know what I'm saying? So it's literally like that, and I think nuance, all this stuff is important. And the funny thing is we didn't even hardly get to the JFK thing, which I was going to get to with you and definitely going to cover with Larry, because we could talk about the propaganda involved there. We could talk about the different films, both pushing in various different directions regarding conspiracy advocacy, regarding the lone nut solution, if you will. We've seen this go on and on and on throughout our lives, where there's been different shifts and different sort of postures taken by the government, the officials, the people involved. I was searching in my mind for Robert Tannenbaum's name earlier, because he wrote a fictional book, too, that had a lot of truth in it related to the assassination. And meanwhile, he was an investigator on the HSCA during a time when Blakey was there. And, you know, I would argue that portion of it was kind of a limited hangout. And it's still having resonance today. I know you saw the recent thing passed around about Gail Nix Jackson and her attempts to retrieve her grandfather's film. She's got a lawsuit going now, and indeed there's proof that she's assembled in a very interesting way, that the HSCA literally had their hands on the film that she has been now in search of for 40 years, right? So, you know, or maybe longer. I'm not sure how long she's actually been involved in it, but my understanding is She's been looking to find her grandfather's original film now for about 40 years. And even a small issue like that can reveal a great deal about the way propaganda is handled, about the way government handles, you know, things that are supposed to be important documentation, whether it's a film or a historical document, etc. Very fascinating. Gotten a little bit of attention in the New York Post and stuff recently, but nationally you don't hear it being discussed very much. It's not a headline news event, and very much like what we were talking about with the rise and fall of the Third Reich. That wasn't just popular in the 50s. That continued to be a mildly popular book for decades because of the revelatory way with which a lot of things were revealed there. People are always curious to know about history, but at the same time display some levels of apathy too. So it's very interesting, and it's a great effort that you're going to be involved in here with this next Vietnam book. Can't wait to see how it turns out. But now I'll just shut up and give you about 4 or 5 minutes to conclude anything you want to conclude here. But we're going to talk to Larry Hancock in the next hour about the reframing of Lee Harvey Oswald, and I don't mean to frame him for a crime. So by all means, Mike, go ahead, continue.
Yeah. I'll just connect how this applies to the assassination.
Sure.
the whole Germany stuff. So the second historical argument about the Holocaust is that it drew out of the bureaucracy. And it wasn't simply like Hitler, you know, he didn't dream up himself personally how it would be carried out. He didn't come up with the idea of putting people in concentration camps and gassing them. What happened is he would create the broad policy objectives, which when it comes to this topic, the first wasn't actually, let's just kill everybody, but it was remove them from Germany.
Right.
And as the war developed, they came up with different ideas of how to do that. Let's send people into Poland. Maybe after we defeat the Soviet Union, we'll just keep sending them further and further, you know, east and use people as slaves, basically.
Well, you disenfranchise them. Yeah, they would disenfranchise them, send them to the ghettos, this kind of thing, so that they would be concentrated not in a camp, but in an area which would restrict their movement, restrict everything they could do, and it would strip them of all of the things that they had gained throughout their lives, and they would become non-persons that would be pushed out of the territorial area. That was one methodology, and again, bureaucrats came around and said, not very efficient, boss. So they would present him with other ideas. I mean, that's the way I understand it, but go ahead.
Mm-hmm. What happened was once they started to lose the war and it started to go, you know, they were going backwards instead of forwards,
right.
The realization came that we're not going to be able to put them somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And then they started to say, well, we're just going to have to start to kill them here. So that's, in a nutshell, you know, the driving force of what happened, but the ideas of how to do it would be created by mid-level people and then taken to the top for approval and then implemented. The point of that is that's how I think basically all national security states operate, is very rarely is someone like, let's say, Alan Dulles coming up with this master plan to do something, right. But instead people in the lower levels are coming up with ideas and then getting them, if they match the objectives, the broad objectives as outlined, you know, at the top, then they can get them approved and then they implement them. And that whole process, though, pretty much gets lost to history, you know.
Right. Well, and that's an interesting thing too. Often the missed thing, right, is that people want to point the finger at the prominent character who indeed did create a policy, but didn't create all the mechanisms by which it was enacted. So, you know, there are lots of other people, and we talked about this before, about contingency plans and things like that, how there are people employed as we speak right now coming up with contingency plans that might have no realistic use at any point in time, but they want them in hand because the guy who's in control of the situation, the Alan Dulles's, say, in your scenario, they get handed a whole lot of work that somebody else already did and said, you know, if we use this and we use this kind of person and so on and so forth, this is what it would cost us and this is what it would take to get it done this way. And they hand them mechanisms and choices. And that is the functionality of the bureaucracy, right? I mean, it doesn't matter if it's military intelligence, if it's, governmental, social issues, taking care of food stamps, all this stuff. Somebody's in charge, yes, indeed. But they are not usually even the visionary. They just kind of sign off on things, and a whole lot of people figure out the nuts and bolts of how to get that done, and that's all levels of subordinates. And that's a reality that a lot of people miss when they're interested in a historical topic of any kind, right? And it doesn't matter if it's a nefarious thing or if it's a mundane operation. It all functions right. Sort of the same, right?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, for sure. So, like, to me, the idea, like, saying, like, George Bush killed Kennedy, I don't really think that makes any sense.
Well, yeah, exactly, because, he would have never been the mechanic. He's shown no proclivity for being an assassin, a shooter, right? I mean, this is, I realize he was, a veteran and he was a pilot and whatnot, but honestly, his track record shows nothing that would suggest that he's like the guy who's dreaming up, ways to lay out shooters and things like this. It's not his area of expertise. Now, if you're saying to me that he's a guy who would have dreamed this up, I again object because he wasn't in a position of power where he's being presented all these, underlings' plans and objectives and things like that. So he's really not in a good spot, in my mind, to be a mastermind or a mechanic, right? And this is the problem, and people mix the two up where it's like, this is a smart guy. He knows how to get things done, but that's not the guy who gives the orders a lot of times. You know, the man who is the expert shooter, even a famous sniper like Carlos Hathcock, he's not deciding what missions to go on, but he knows how to execute them. Right. And that's the thing here. There are people play their different roles here, and I think a lot of people ascribe it's like that's the nefarious mastermind, that's the guy who came up with everything, he's the guy who comes up with all the little details, and it's like, dude, that's not the way the real world works, and that's the fascinating thing to go through when you actually study these things from a realistic perspective. What do you think of that, Mike?
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things that they were studying right before the assassination, a couple months beforehand, Desmond Fitzgerald, who was overseeing all the CIA operations against Cuba, mm-hmm. he was at a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and said that they're studying how the failed assassination attempt against Hitler was carried out. So maybe they could apply that against Castro somehow. So, that they were studying these sort of things themselves
right.
to figure out how to do stuff.
Right. Well, I mean, listen, if you have a successful or an unsuccessful assassination plot that you know the details about, you could learn from that if you're looking to enact your own, right? Okay, where did these guys fail? You mean to tell me this simple mistake and maybe all these things would have just went down properly and it failed? Great. Now we got another one that's completely successful, but why did it succeed? Maybe we can copy some of those things. Okay, this is the way they handled the press. This is the way they handled the guy's personal security. These were successful methodologies. Would they work the same way here? Yeah, and there's a whole array of underlings that are studying these things like at all times, right? So it's not always just the mastermind, the prominent name. I argue, in fact, that the majority of the people that come up with the nuts and bolts are very difficult to discover for people like you and me, because we have to dig through many layers, and then you don't have a headline name that people are attracted to that want to learn about automatically.
Yeah, it's very difficult. The thing about the Holocaust, I said, I read a book describing all this and the names and, who did the innovations, who tested it, who came up with the idea of using gas, and they had people tested on people and this and that. I forget who these people are. You can't,
No, but you needed engineers.
Unmemorable,
You needed people with scientific knowledge. You needed people with engineering backgrounds. You needed all that. And that's not the guy who's walking around goose-stepping, okay? It's just not the guy. But they need to hand the information to those guys in order for them to enact their bigger plan, which again was probably handed to somebody else. I mean, you know, a guy who actually moves people is not always the guy who owns the company, right? That's why there are personnel managers in any organization. So, you know, there's that aspect of it too, where their whole job is not to think, is not to create, is not to do anything, is just to manage people to accomplish the goals that they are given. So, you know, again, there are many layers to it, and there's a lot of things to be studied. Meanwhile, we're going to study a few things in the next hour with Larry Hancock. Stick around. Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com. Again, be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com and learn a great deal about the world around you. It's not just about Wall Street. Also, the author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War, the first in a series of at least three volumes on that conflict, and I'm looking forward to it. Mike, thanks for being here, and I definitely look forward to Larry Hancock in the next hour.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
You're listening to the Ocelli.com radio network.
History that you were never taught in schools.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War,
by author Mike Swanson.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination broken into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Going to Chuck Ocelli.
When you're Chuck Ocelli, you know what you're Chuck Ocelli.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened. He will fight savagely, man to man. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
In denial.
Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
What would I do? Revelation through conversation. In a radio show / podcast. You want the good news? Listen to the Ocelli Effect. Chuck Ocelli is the most underrated voice in all media. News, education, and entertainment. The Daily Bread from Ocelli.com. Go there. Save yourself from ignorance. Ocelli.com. But we all agreed to put Ocelli.com on and listen to the Ocelli Effect. Revelation through conversation. Ocelli.com.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
Second segment of this Thor's Day Night Ocelli Effect now, in effect, if you will, at Ocelli.com and the various places that you get your podcasts from, because I don't know, you're mostly listening at other times, other places, and all that good stuff. Meanwhile, are you lucky? Yes, you are, because you have the second segment featuring author Larry Hancock, who, again, occupies more spots on my bookshelf than any other author, with good reason. Actually, I talked to somebody recently about you quickly, Larry, and was saying, yeah, well, obviously, run things by Larry Hancock if you can first. when somebody said, what do you think of this, regarding a presentation that had to do with JFK. But you do a lot of other things. I could list all of his books if you like, everybody. I mean, Creating Chaos, Unidentified, which I look forward to speaking about in the very near future. But tonight we're going to talk about, well, what I keep saying is the reframing of Oswald, and I don't mean framing him for the crime. I do mean reframing the portrait. Larry tends to use the phrase, how about we look at Oswald in three dimensions? Get away from the two-dimensional viewpoints that a lot of people have on this. And I'm going to let Larry explain it, because he is, well, really the most consistent historical presenter on the show, who comes up with some rather sober and excellent points of view regarding things that are not necessarily the mainstream point of view always. But as we talked about with Mike in the first hour, he is often involved with the behaviors of the national security state. That is sort of the subgenre, if you will, that that Larry focuses on mostly. And you can find that in Surprise Attack and Shadow Warfare, which we mentioned in the first hour. But, you know, you go all the way back to Someone Would Have Talked. And indeed, they did talk. A lot of people did. But are we getting a clear view of this historical character known as Lee Harvey Oswald from any side of the alleged equation here? I don't think so. So I love the fact that Larry is sort of re-examining this after so many years of studying it, and I'm glad to have you along. Larry, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine. It's good to be back, Chuck.
Absolutely. And go to larry-hancock.com. Follow Larry's work, and also could be that if you're going to the Lancer conference this year, which I am, and I know some of you guys are planning on meeting me there, you might be able to meet Larry Hancock there as well. Looking forward to that. By the way, I have secured a supply of some of Mike Swanson's books, the Why the Vietnam War book. I'm going to have those in tow at the conference, along with other stuff. And I have the swag program going on now. Once again, I'll make an announcement that if you want to be part of a promotional video for the swag program, which is none of this merchandise is going on sale, but for supporters of the network, starting at a $50 donation, you'll be guaranteed a hat from one of the shows that you like on the network. You can pick that. But I'm going to randomly insert other swag, which could be T-shirts, stickers, keychains, wallets even. All of this stuff in very limited runs, only a handful of any of these products produced, and you'll be able to get that, decks of cards, by the way, and a few other things that are specially branded, celebrating the 10 years of the Ocelli Effect that have been in effect, so to speak. So if you want to be a part of that promotional video, which will only take a couple of minutes to shoot, and you use Skype, get in touch with me, let me know, and we'll get that done tonight and get it out probably by the morning. And hopefully I'll get this podcast out, because this is some good stuff. I mean, we wound up talking about World War II and the Third Reich and propaganda in the first hour, which I didn't expect, but that was historical context for something else Mike is going to talk about in weeks to come. And hopefully we'll be able to drag Carmine Savastano on the show to talk about maybe some evidence destruction in the JFK assassination theater, if you will. But meanwhile, how about evidence mutilation that's gone on regarding the historical character of Lee Harvey Oswald? Back around, Larry Hancock. So where should we begin with this conversation that I think we're going to be able to accomplish in about 40 minutes here? And I'm going to suspend the commercial break. We'll just end when we end. Larry, where should we begin with this topic once again?
Well, I think what we need to do is, and you mentioned it several times in the remarks that you just made, Chuck, is to go back to historical sources. One of the things, you know, you and I have talked, and we've done JFK 101, we've looked at all of this, but one of the things I decided at this point in time was that I needed to go back and and take a look at Lee Oswald from a truly historical perspective, not from a Warren Commission perspective, not from a JFK research community perspective, because I started getting the sense that everybody wanted to put him in the box. And everybody wanted to treat him as a certain type of historical figure, regardless of who he really was. And so I think the way I think of it as three dimensions is, you know, the Warren Commission looked at the dimension of Oswald as the presidential assassin.
Right.
And quite frankly, that's what they were interested in, and that was their charter. And
well, the kooky kid, the communist.
So
yeah, the kooky
when
kid.
Start out with
the kooky kid, the communist, the subversive, obviously he would be the kind of guy who would do this. They were prejudging him. I mean, even if you look at the organization of the Warren Commission to begin with, right? They set up these subcommittees, and I think, what was it, three or four or five of them? Maybe there was five altogether or four. And the majority of them, at least three out of that box, were all about Lee Harvey Oswald and his guilt, basically. I mean, and that was it. That was the predetermined kind of thing. And even people that want to advocate for the idea that he was innocent, they go at it and try and create a sympathetic character and so on and so forth, therefore influencing the end result of what should honestly be objectively attained, right? Shouldn't we seize upon this guy and figure out who he actually was, forgetting about your sentimentality? Wouldn't that be a wiser thing to do, Larry?
Yeah, and I think you can see it so clearly. I think I see it. You see it more clearly if you really know the players. I mean, if you know that the FBI was chartered to write a report presenting him as the single assassination. Okay, well, we know that as a fact. Let's just start with that. And they are the primary source for the Warren Commission. How could the Warren Commission deal with the subject objectively if that's their starting point, right? I mean, it's just, and then we look, I've been rereading a lot of the testimony given it to the Warren Commission, and you can see that their staff members are working, you know, they're not, they're prosecution staff. You can see it in the questions they ask, the way they channel the interviews. People have come down really hard on people like Marina Oswald. But when you start looking at it, well, everybody says you can't trust anything Marina says because she lies. Actually, in a lot of cases, she's pretty credible. They're just steering the questions to the extent of putting her in a certain position where whatever she says supports what they want to support.
Right.
You know, they steer witnesses incredibly and obviously. So I think that's it's so clear. And in the report itself, I've also been checking statements from people that they cite. You know, like you and I have talked about one of Oswald's buddies in the Marine Corps, Delgado.
Right.
Okay. Delgado had a lot to say about Lee Oswald. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read his interviews, you know, he has a lot to say, but they just pick, when you look at, get away from the interview and look at what goes into their summary report on Lee Oswald's character, they cherry pick.
Right.
So they were building a case. The Warren Commission report is not an investigation. It's an argument for guilt. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, just kind of accept that. And certainly we do now. But I'm afraid that there are equal sins on the other side, because when I start looking at what's written by the JFK community, as you said, there is a lot of writing that really wants to portray him as kind of being totally innocent, gullible, plastic, if you will, pliable. You know, he's always being used by someone.
Right.
There's
poor
always
kid.
Someone using it, Lee Oswald, giving him orders.
Well,
and
on
he's
the one side,
orders.
Right, on the one side, and they'll do that all the way from his mother to the Marine Corps and on and on. They'll try and present him as a guy who was constantly being told what to do on the one hand, but then when it suits them, they'll go in another direction. And if you want to see something, I'm sure it's still available on YouTube, if you want to see the type of steering of Delgado in particular, you can watch Bugliosi try and steer him during that mock trial. in what was it, 88 or you know, in that time period there, around the 25th anniversary, which of course grew into his ridiculous, you know, cinder block of a book later. But I mean, that whole thing that British television company did, right? The on trial, mm-hmm. Lee Harvey Oswald. You can watch Delgado get pushed around and also express his attitude problems, which I got to experience talking to him myself, where he's like, look, why are you guys trying to, you know, make me say stuff? Why, you know, and that's how he interpreted it. And that's literally what they do, because guess what? It's not even about look at the evil people trying to frame Lee. No, it's actually just prosecutors doing what they do, which is, why am I going to bother finding out about whether this guy likes to whistle Dixie while he works? It doesn't matter to my case. Let me just unearth the things that are supportive of my prosecutorial brief, right? And that's what they did, whether it was Bugliosi on TV or it was the Warren Commission, you know, during that process, which was not fairly adversarial, as Mark Lane famously complained about. It wasn't like a real court proceeding, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of ways to look at this. And yet, at the end of the day, what you end up with is, if people go in with a preconceived agenda, then they will shape what it is they choose to not only highlight, but begin to collect, begin to reveal to others, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, you're going to have an automatic distortion, no matter what point you want to make, because you really need to step back and allow the whole thing to come in so that we have a clear picture of the historical character, right?
Yeah, so the bottom line is, I can no longer accept Lee Oswald from what I see in the Warren Commission report summaries, mm-hmm. Okay? I can no longer accept Lee Oswald in terms of what I see in almost everything written in the JFK research community.
Right.
Obviously, that kind of makes me an outsider, but what that kind of forced me to do is, the only way to test this stuff for me was to go back and look at his real history. Now, the fascinating thing is, his real history, to a large extent, is documented quite well by the Warren Commission. It's just that they didn't use it. You know, they documented it. They gathered the data about his childhood, about his school life, about the test he took, about, you know, just literal facts, just the facts.
Right.
But, of course, that's not what shows up in the summary report. Mm-hmm. So I'm going, okay, I've got to get back to the facts. You know, let me get inside his school life. Let me get inside, you know, how he tested. For example, one of the things that jumped out, or two things that really jump out when you get back to his real character and personality is, he was bright. There's no doubt about it. From his very first elementary school test all the way through his Marine Corps testing, he was bright. He was not a klutz in any way, shape, or form from an IQ standpoint, from an intelligence standpoint. When he wanted to do something, he tested well.
Right.
When he didn't want to do something, he tested poorly. It's all situational. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what that's what you don't see in the Warren Commission. That's what you don't see in the JFK community, is the degree to which his behavior is situational.
And that doesn't mean that you can't present him as somewhat klutzy or clumsy in a physical sense, because, I mean, we are, after all, talking about a guy who accidentally shot himself in the leg with, yes. You know, and that's historical record. While he was in the Marine Corps, what was one of his, you know, his, do they call it a court martial in the Marine Corps? Where he was disciplined, anyway, was because he had an unauthorized firearm that he injured himself with, which is true. So this is part of the picture, too. Even though he may have been very intelligent.
His physical, it's kind of like, there is no doubt that Lee Oswald liked guns. You know, there just is no argument from his high school friend who says, I talk with Lee and he's really interested in, maybe we could break into a pawn shop and steal a pistol, because he really wanted a pistol. Well, he got one in Japan, and as you say, dropped it and hurt himself. When he got into Russia, what does he do in Russia? He buys a shotgun and joins a hunting club.
Right.
You know, so that's very consistent. Now, was he a good shot? No. Was he clumsy? Yes. But I know a lot of people who have guns who are both clumsy and, you know, you don't want to go out hunting with them because when they unload their shotgun, they're liable to screw up and, you know, you get the ricochet pellets off the ground. So those aren't, they're separate things. Clumsiness right. and ability is not, you know, wanting to do something. But, so yeah, you've got to look for the patterns. I think the other thing that jumps right out, and it astounds me how many people, Lee Oswald, from the very first moment that you start looking at his actual life, his character, his personality, Lee Oswald does not take orders. Mm-hmm. Unless, you know, he does not. He does not play well with others. The least effective way of getting Lee to do what you want him to do is to give him an order. And he will get his back up, and he blows every job he ever has in the end because he gets bored mm-hmm. with the job. He doesn't take orders well. He didn't make him. This doesn't matter whether he's in high school or in the Marines or in Russia. I mean, this is a guy, and you and I have both talked about Titovits. I mean, right. This is a guy who gets a great job inside Russia in a factory, a relatively great job, good apartment, relative lots of money. And what happens? He's in Russia, and he can't get along with his coworkers.
Right.
And he starts screwing up and making life difficult for the managers who are in charge of him. And he starts criticizing the system. Can you just see this ex-Marine goes to Russia and starts creating a problem in the Russian workplace?
Right.
How many people do we know that write about that as part of Oswald's real character?
Well, you know, they don't.
He must be a really great spy.
And it's very consistent.
He just makes himself outstanding.
Right. It's very
difficult.
It's very consistent, actually, across his entire life story that he has a problem with authority because he's either bucking his mother's authority, whatever, judge her any which way you want, but he bucks his mother's authority to some degree. He's causing problems in the Marine Corps. He's got problems in school listening to authority. This is not a guy who easily falls in line, and that is an apparent pattern. Now, we only have up until he's 24 years of age because that's when he died. But still, you have a well-established pattern here of he doesn't just quietly accept the declarations of the authority, whether it's the bosses in the factory or it's whoever, even when he's dealing with, you know, the people at the consulate, right? I mean, go ahead.
His biggest problem in life, as I would cut, that is a pattern that recurs over and over again, is how quickly he gets bored,
mm-hmm.
which actually speaks to his intelligence and the fact that he has a hard time getting into jobs that he would consider really challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But even when he gets in the Marine Corps, he tests well. He gets into a technical skill level. I mean, he gets into radar and aircraft equipment. Man, this is one of the best and most technical, and he's in Marine Air. He's not in Marine Infantry.
Mm-hmm.
So he has a relatively plush job, and he's happy with it. His performance reports come in good. His supervisor says that he's a good calm radar, calm under pressure, good radar operator, and then he gets bored with the job and starts screwing up.
Right.
In Texas, he gets really kind of a plum job with a graphics company, really enjoys that, and then gets bored with it. It's over and over, he creates problems for himself by getting bored with things, including bored with Marina. You know, for Lee Oswald, everything is enthusiastic for, you know, like 90 days, and then it's not. He cannot maintain his enthusiasm, and he goes off on tangents, and it all, you know, what was good yesterday collapses. I was intrigued. I had forgotten. He had a reasonably good job, early job in Texas in a metalworking plant, not a great job, but, mm-hmm. you know, he had done metalwork in Russia. And he had a steady job, steady income, and one day he comes home and tells Marina, well, they fired me.
Right.
Well, no, they didn't. And when they were interviewed by the Warren Commission. It's like, oh, he was okay. He was kind of a, you know, might be a difficult to talk to, but he did the job well, and we were actually, he was getting good performance reviews up until the time he didn't show up for work anymore.
Right.
So, you know, there are personality characteristics, and these that are constant over time, even as you said, even for just 24 years, and those have to be brought into play. And quite frankly, that was not at all part of the summary reports that the Warren Commission does, and is missing from most of the conspiracy writing.
Well, right, and the other part of the context here is that it's not just about, okay, yes, it's clearly an intelligent person that gets bored with the mundane or the less intricate, challenging jobs or schoolwork or whatever. True, but it also doesn't mean that he's the super genius that some people have tried to make him into either, right? Because the super genius might have found a way to cope with this and been a bit more pragmatic and not created these other ancillary problems that come along with the tangential issues that now come along with he didn't hold the job, etc., right? So on the one hand, you have somebody who's probably, you know, more than average intelligence, but he's also not the super spy that some people make him into either. I mean, they practically make him into a James Bond-like figure in some cases, and I'm like, whoa, hold on. Maybe he was capable of some of that, but yeah. Good.
Yeah. The thing is that we have factual information on that. There's no reason to speculate because Oswald, when he got back, well, even in the Marines, I mean, he took tests all the time.
Right.
He took intelligence tests in school. He took, tests in the Marines. When he came back, he kept going to, you know, apply for jobs, and he would take screening tests with job placement in Texas. And interestingly enough, if you look at his records, basically, it's obviously he was well-read. I mean, that's one thing you can establish. He's well-read.
Right.
When he wants to, he can hold a very good conversation. Even his officers in the Marines would admit that, A, he was, you know, difficult and challenging and annoying, but he could hold a conversation on, say, politics or international affairs on the level of the officers themselves. And one of the reasons he was a pain in the rear is he would try to make himself look equal to or superior to an officer, which, you know, that doesn't go down well. But even in his reviews, they admit that. And then in the job placements, in several instances, they really write it up as saying we could try to place him in a higher level job, but he's unemployed, he's got a wife, she's pregnant, or has a child, he needs money, so we're going to have to put him in a lower level job right now because he needs money.
Mm-hmm.
So this is fact. This is not supposition. These are people who tested him, interviewed him. So no, he's not, the way you would place him in terms of intelligence and potential in a job market is they actually say, you know, college entry or college, you know, undergraduate level. But the problem is that's where he might be, you know, at knowledge-wise, but he doesn't have any skills to go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he never developed that. So that also puts him in a very difficult position, and I think that's one of the things we often, looking at those kind of records, which are kind of dull and boring and whatever, you know, that's not what we see in a lot of conspiracy writing. We don't see in conspiracy writing that Lee Oswald got a job at the school book depository and was already bored and looking for other jobs.
Right.
And had applied for other jobs already.
Right.
That doesn't fit well with the general, Lee Oswald is part of a conspiracy that has to have him in the school book depository, right?
Well, and it also doesn't help that he's dysfunctional to a certain degree because, look, either he is a well-organized and, you know, somebody who pulled this off, okay, and can functionally get things done, or he's not, right? So he seems to have functional problems sort of getting things done, but he's intelligent enough to understand complex things that might require, again, some level of intelligence, a bit above average. So you have those two things to balance where, again, unless it's very exciting and intriguing to him, you're not going to keep him engaged well enough to have him functionally accomplish things. And even then, it's almost like a time limit because, okay, let's put him in here. We can train him for something. The JCS, the Jackson Child Snowball incident, is very interesting there, right? Because there was plenty of room for him to maybe get into other areas. Might have been more challenging with that job, but he didn't stay, right? So there you go, right? I mean, all right. So go ahead.
He can't focus for long enough to really become skilled. I mean, he dabbles. Right. Oswald is a dabbler. Oswald is kind of a short attention span, you know, not in terms of minutes, but in terms of weeks or months. And to some extent, you almost kind of expect this. This is a kid who, up until his, like, sophomore year in high school, and he was averaging two or three schools a year, mm-hmm. and moving back and forth, that's, with that kind of background, that doesn't, you know, you don't, he didn't do anything for very long. He didn't develop any ability to slog, you know, just apply himself, because it would have made no sense. He's somewhere else, you know, he's moved on. Right. There's no history, but
and it's interesting it's interesting too. You bring up the Marina thing because, and this will be the last like big comment I make, and I want to let you run with it after this, because I think this is necessary to recognize as well. They try not only to point out his levels of intellect and sort of ride it and steer it into one column or the other inaccurately, and I do mean from all sides of people trying to draw out this character, but emotionally they do it too, where there's this, you know, look, he's a dedicated Marxist, right? He is so entirely invested in that he's like fanatical, and that's the thing that drove him. And, you know, okay, well, you go with that, and that doesn't quite fit with the portrait I'm seeing emotionally. Again, he got bored. You know, the wife was probably exciting because she's an oddity. She's from Russia. She's from that place. She's different, right? So she's an oddity, and then he gets bored with her. Everything, it seems like, goes this way, right? Where, you know, again, the emotional makeup of the man is adapted for people that want to make him the assassin. He has to be really, really inconsistent and really intense. And on the other hand, if you want to make him Mr. Innocent, he has to be very steady and very, you know, like, oh, I'm just not really looking for trouble, but, you know, I have different ideas about the world. You can't really fit him in either one of those boxes, despite the fact that people place him there.
And I think a good example of this, you and I have both talked about this, I'd encourage everybody to read Titovitz's book on Oswald in Russia.
Absolutely.
To get a real feeling for this. I think one of the things that was most striking to me is, you know, Oswald became socially outgoing and successful with women in Japan. Okay, mm-hmm. He had not been before then, but that's an absolute fact that things changed for him that way in Japan.
Right.
But that was still a new thing for him. In Russia, Titovitz writes about how, you know, Oswald really had a number of sexual conquests. They dated. It was easy for him to date because of his apartment. The girls' school was handy. But after a certain period of time, he even gets bored with that. Like, okay, and Titovitz is going, and now we're not going over to the girls' school anymore, and Oswald just spending a lot of time at home by himself, and
right.
He's starting to get depressed, and you start going, wait a minute, what does this guy want? This dedicated, devoted Marxist, who's also a spy, right? I mean, he's got a charter. He's in Russia, and, you know, is he trying to ingratiate himself within the factory complex, become a great worker, get transferred to the area where they're actually making military radio systems? Does he start trying to make? No, he gets bored of even of the women at the girls' school, and just, you know, he gets bored, mm-hmm. and that's the real Oswald. And so you've got to really get your head around the real personality and the character if we're going to deal with him, you know, in the fall of 1963 in Dallas. Yeah. And your comment about Marina is, people ignore what Marina has to say about Oswald, which is really mixed. Marina is very on the money when she talks about Lee Oswald and his good side and his bad side. And yes, he would be set you pain that they didn't live together all that much. I mean, once they got back in the States, they were constantly apart. She was living with friends. It's really only for like 3 months in early 1963 where they're living together, where he's working at Jagger Stovall. Mm-hmm. And then he leaves that, and in New Orleans, they're living together for a couple of months. You know, this is not a couple that is in sync necessarily. Her interests are not his interest. It's pretty clear that Marina was a typical Russian woman of her period, educated, but not politically interested. Certainly not politically. Oswald is more interested in geopolitics and then certainly he can't talk to Marina about that. Oswald is, you and I have also discussed what Oswald is writing. Oswald takes a typing course,
right,
and is really big into writing various critiques in 1963. People have got to read those to understand the real Oswald. He's not talking to Marina about that. Marina's work dealing with the kids. She's trying to learn to cook, you know, an American ranch. So when people take her to task because she doesn't answer everybody's questions, she doesn't answer them accurately, she seems to wonder and so on and so forth, you know, you got to look at the relationship between those two. Mm-hmm. They got into fights, they made up, she wanted him to make money, and she had married him because he looked like he would be a good American prospect, and it's not turning out that way. And even at the very last, it's kind of like, Lee, you need to step up. You know, okay, I'll come back and live with you if you show you can make something of yourself. And Oswald's on and off about that.
Right.
You know, he'll be good with that for 30 days or 60 days, and then he's off to something else.
Right. And I mean, look, in complete sympathetic fairness to her, she's confronted with a culture shock. I mean, you know, what is expected of her as a Russian woman is very different when she's in America. You know, she's got different expectations, a language barrier, a lot of things going on there, you know. And then meanwhile, the inconsistency of their living situation means she's not necessarily familiar with everything, although she does have a good feel for him because she does know him better than a whole lot of other people who are very transient in his life, right? So, you know, it's a mixed bag. You're not going to get a consistent, well, she knows him so well, oh so well. But at the same time, she does know who he was, you know. So it almost sounds like I'm contradicting, but I'm not. It's a mixed situation here. It's not all, you know, again, like you said, the complexities of his political and social views. She might have known them generally, but did she really know the nuances of them? Could she have known them if he's expressing them in English anyway, versus whatever knowledge he had of the Russian language, right? Could he have even communicated that to her as
and
well?
And there's another factor there too, Chuck. I mean, Oswald lied to her. And we've got to be forthright about that. Mm-hmm. Oswald wanted the other patterns that Oswald had. It just constantly, it's not that he's pathological, but when Oswald gets stressed or when he gets backed into a corner, he lies. And he doesn't lie very well because, you know, if you look at it over time, even when he gets back to the United States and he's interviewed by the FBI, which, you know, you probably should want to get your story straight, he goes, well, I didn't offer to defect. I didn't do this and that when I was in Russia. And they immediately check with the State Department. And yes, he did say that. And yes, he said he never wanted to return to the U.S. again. So Oswald is under stress. He lies. Mm. And he doesn't do it very well. Certainly not like a trained agent should. But he also, you know, when you look at his job applications, he embellishes things. He puts in, you know, things that are not right. So the whole pattern is, when you're looking at what Marina says, you are hearing what she's heard from Lee, and that might not be correct. You know, so people falter for, well, we know this. And we're like, we may not know that, and we may know that now, but you have no idea what Marine knew at the time.
Right. Right, and it's really interesting that a guy in his position, if people want to support the idea that he was some sort of master spy, very important to note that he would have actually shut his mouth a lot more, as opposed to talking, as opposed to making a point of getting involved in certain conversations, right? Like, you literally see that all the way going back to Japan, where he's interjecting himself in situations where, if you're a spy, you don't hand them a bunch of things that could be contradictory or embellishments or whatever. You don't offer that because you don't. It's not part of the equation, right? This is not the way somebody who's trying to, only have attention paid to them in certain circumstances behaves. And then when he's dealing with her, he might also be thinking, well, she doesn't know anything. She can't even speak the language. It's not like she could go and check things on me. Maybe his lies are a little more sloppy because he doesn't feel as though he needs to tighten them up with her. And that's the thing. All of these things are worthy of consideration when looking at this character, right?
And I think here's an example, and I know people won't like it, but I'll be writing about it to some extent. Go. I think the perfect picture of their relationship, and it's a real world relationship. It's a pro-con, like a lot of marriages, a lot of couples. Mm-hmm. At times it's good, and at times it's not good. But mm-hmm. the photo, the backyard photo that's left for the Warren Shield,
right?
Which the copy on the front is signed by Lee, okay, and it's kind of like, okay, this is for my buddy. And on the back, Marina writes, "Hunter of Fascist." Mm-hmm. Now, that strikes me as a real couple. You know, it's kind of like, this is what the wife would have said to your buddy's wife, kind of punching you in the back for, you know, like bragging or, you know, that's the guys say their thing, and in the background the women are going, yeah, right.
Right. Yeah, I mean, look, you can see that in a real world example where somebody's, you know, talking up about some situation they were in, and quite often a wife will come in and undercut it. You know, oh yeah, well, I stood up and I said something and I was a big tough guy and this and that. And then the wife kind of walks in the room and sort of goes, yeah, well, that's funny. How are you able to do that ducking under the counter there? Cause that's the way I remember it happening.
Yeah.
You know, and I've seen that happen.
That just seems so real. It's like you yeah. just can't avoid it. That's gotta be real stuff. And, and Marina, I think, since we're talking about her, one of the parts of the equation is people liked her. People did not generally like Lee unless there are a handful of people. If you sort of agreed with Lee's worldview,
mm-hmm.
you could become a friend of his, like Pitovitz did.
Right.
I mean, you didn't have to agree with him, but if you agreed to some extent, you could actually get bond with him to the extent that you could argue or have fights or disagree, and, you know, he does not push you away.
Right.
That didn't happen very often. Titovitz is one. Delgado is another in the Marines. De Mornshield
mm-hmm.
clearly is one. And where Lee would have exchanges with him. And De Mornshield gets ignored because we put everybody in a box, right? De Mornshield, you know, reported on Oswald to a government agency. Yeah, De Mornshield reported on a lot of things to government agencies.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that when he talks about Lee as his friend, he's not a viable resource, especially if it's consistent and it checks out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the traps that we build for ourselves is, you know, throw the baby out with the bath or whatever is, you know, there, we've gotten to the point where people won't cite something out of a book or from a source because they don't like it.
Right.
This source is wrong about this, so I don't accept anything they have to say. Oh, this source did this, you know, this source took a position on that I don't agree with, so nothing in their book is viable.
Right.
I think that's silly. And I feel the same way, which is why I've turned to sources like Jack Swike, who investigated Oswald and the Marines, or to Titovitz, or mm-hmm. to De Mornshield, for that matter. to kind of say, what are they saying that I can learn something from, and not just throw it away because it doesn't match what I want Oswald to be. You know, that's not my choice. Oswald is what he was, and why should I turn away from somebody who actually knew him and go, oh, well, I'm going to believe what I read in this book versus the person who really knew him for 3 months and
right.
and helped his family and provably,
well,
you know,
like
not made up or anything like that.
Yeah, like here's the thing with De Morenshield, right? Which is very interesting. Yeah, he's a sketchy character. Yes, he's somebody that you better, you know, get some grains of salt ready for on a lot of topics. But when he describes the idea that, like, look, Marina, people wanted to help Marina. They wanted to fix her teeth and all that. Remember? That whole bit where the other Russians mm-hmm. in town there, they just, you know, wanted to help their fellow Russian, and they liked her, right? They wanted to help her. But he was a big turnoff for a lot of people, just personally. It didn't matter about, you know, well, De Morenshields was attached to him because of intelligence. Maybe so. But when you're talking about this kind of situation where he describes that dynamic, there's no reason to say that De Morenshields is not reliable when relating that sort of concept. Yeah. I mean, you could hate De Morenshields all you want, but yeah, go ahead.
That De Morenshields points out, it's sort of like, look, and again, this is so real life, it's difficult to reject. He said, look, everybody liked Marina. Marina was easy to get along with. Lee was, unless you absolutely agreed with his worldview, was an asshole. Okay?
Yeah.
He would argue with you, he would whatever, which obviously the Russian expatriates are not going to be very much in sync with Lee Oswald. You know, that's why they're here in the first place. But everybody liked Marina, but there got to be a point when she decided to go back and live with Oswald after having been separated from him several times, left him, whatever, where they just kind of threw up their hands and said, oh, it's just not worth it. Yeah, she's nice, but if we try to maintain contact, then we have to deal with him, and we're not going to do it.
Yeah,
you know,
that's just
the way it is. That's too real world to ignore. No, nobody's making that up.
Well, it's a very real world. Look, you and I have lived long enough that we have encountered somebody that we might really appreciate, right? And they might be a good person to have around, and we're forming a friendship or a working relationship with them, but somehow their spouse or their child is somehow injected into the situation, and since that person comes along with this other person, you go, all right, look, I really like them, but I can't deal with, you know, for whatever reason, right? The person's just plain obnoxious or is counterproductive or hinders that person directly while they're working in a group. You and I have both encountered this. It's not them, but their spouse makes it unlivable. And it sounds to me like that's one of these situations where you could be like, look, Marina's just fine. We'd love to help her. We like her. She's a good person. But since this guy's going to be attached to her, maybe I don't want to be around so much. I mean, and that just sounds like a normal sort of, you know, non-fabricated just happenstance that you tend to believe it because it just makes sense. You know, sometimes you got to go with what makes sense. Yeah, go ahead.
Again, or if you want to put them in the box the other way, the Warren Commission takes examples that make him violently antisocial, not just asocial, but antisocial.
Right.
On the other hand, it's funny. It's like, wait a minute. I just read in the summary report, this is guy's antisocial.
Right.
But over here in the appendix, there are 10 pictures that show him in Russia, you know, like out on picnics, arm around girls, arm around guys, arm around girl and guy, dating, proposed, okay, proposed, not accepted, proposed again, accepted. This is antisocial. He's got 2 children. You know, how antisocial can he, you know, it just, everybody that tries to put him in a box, there's a problem.
Right. He's dating. He's going to dances. This is not an antisocial person who's just like, leave me alone. I just want to stay in my house. No, this is somebody who's interacting, and it's not just now some people are antisocial except when it comes to dating, right? But that's not consistent here. He's inconsistent all the way around enough to tell you that one thing I wouldn't call him, actually, is antisocial. He may be difficult in social situations, right? I mean, just the evidence, the way it's being presented to me. Even when you go back to the girls that talked about him in middle school, right? Again, the trajectory of his full life appears to come out a little clearer if you just start to accept, look, the guy's a little difficult. He makes problems. He likes to be argumentative. And that apparently is something that he had even as a child. And he continued on. Yes, he's willing to date. Yes, he's willing to interact, but only when it really suits him. And if he does interact, there's usually some level of either agree with me or argue with me. And other people, you know, they make their judgments about it. Again, all the way back to middle school. You remember some of the things that we've read, you know, not always official reports, but other interviews conducted by, you know, some of his school age peers, where you'll find, yeah, this is kind of the same guy still.
Or the pictures. Again, I'm always nonplussed. You know, here's a picture out of Grode's book. He has a picture of Oswald in the classroom during the middle of a class, and Oswald is turned around looking at the camera and has his arms up in the air, smiling and clowning around. This guy's the class clown. He's not asocial. He might be annoying, but he's not asocial. Another picture from middle school. Oh, look at that. He's out at the water fountain, and he's talking with this girl. Oh, well, that's not, you know, so there are these disconnects all over the place where it's funny. We talk about disconnects in Warren Commission evidentiary data. There are all sorts of disconnects about Oswald all over the place, which is really, that's why I'm taking the approach, you know, you've got to get away from those two dimensions. There's a dimension where the real Oswald, the real personality, the character comes out, good parts, bad parts, but you got to get the real Oswald if you understand what's going on. In the Warren Commission virtually managed to totally ignore the testimony from Marina and from his mother and from people that knew him. When he comes back from Mexico City, he's frustrated, but he goes back even to the paints. And Ruth may not like him, but the point is, it's like he reset again, like he always does. He resets, and he's looking to make up with Marina. He's getting a job. He's hunting for better jobs. He wants to, and he's having difficulties. And of course, she's just about to have a baby. So, who wants Lee Oswald around at the paint home when she's just about to have? But he's back in a personal mode, if you will. He's not writing his manuscripts anymore. He's not taking pictures of himself. So there's an Oswald that constantly, as I said before, is situational. It's like, what's he like this month? Mm-hmm. Don't tell me what he's like about 6 months. If we want to understand what's going on with him in October and November, what's he like then? Don't fix him, you know, pin him against a dartboard with what he was like in the Marine Corps or what he was like as a teenager or what he was like, you know. What's going on then? Because Oswald does constantly resets about the only word. He gets bored. Something new happens. He goes and looks for a venture. That something doesn't work, then he resets.
I got you. Well, Larry, as we get ready to tie a bow on this one, I just want to offer this little piece of commentary, is that if somebody even takes a look at, say, Robert Groden's books, right, the one, the In Search of Lee Harvey Oswald book, and the other one, Absolute Proof, where he's got a section on Oswald, right, you can take a look at various social situations where Oswald is posing for a camera, who is interacting with people, and so on and so forth. And one thing that you have to declare from that, just that sampling, okay, and that's what I'm confronted with because I didn't know the man, is that you can't ascribe the asocial or fully antisocial label to this guy because it doesn't make sense. An asocial person is going to ignore the camera, turn away from the camera, not want to pose for it, okay? An antisocial person, I tend to believe, would not interact with people as much as is evidenced in the photography. Now, maybe it's just me, but I've even looked at, that one home movie that's out there. It's Thanksgiving, with his brother there, right? you can see he's not purely antisocial. Even if he is antisocial at times, it couldn't possibly be a consistent character trait. And that's all I'm offering here. I'm not saying that, well, we know just based on the foot. We don't. But we do know that some things cannot possibly be fully consistent based on the fact that these things exist. Okay? It's not one or two photographs that exist with him interacting with people. There's a lot of them. And I'm just saying, if you got somebody who's truly antisocial in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, I dare you to find an array of photographs where they're interacting with people, you know? You occasionally catch them at a Christmas photo, maybe. You know what I'm saying? But you won't see a ton of different things, different situations, different social makeups, whether it's friends, family, work, etc., Marines, so on and so forth, where you're going to get such a mixed bag. So the consistency here is literally the inconsistency that is easily observed by this sample. And again, not saying that I have a complete portrait by it. I'm anxiously awaiting when it is you will put this together. Are you gonna do a book on it, or is it gonna be a blog post, or is it gonna be a monograph? What are we gonna eventually see?
I think it will be more like a monograph, trying to pull together pieces. I don't see it as a book. I can see it as an extended monograph. And just kind of doing what you just described, it's interesting that you said that, Chuck, because I can remember back in the CompuServe days being online and having exchanged with a real hardcore lone nut person who would say Oswald just violent and he's antisocial. And it's well, I tell you what, you got the Grodin book? Let's look at page 47. Explain those pictures to me, okay? Right. Tell me how those pictures work with what you just said. And the strange thing is that the exchange, online exchange, would just pretty much end at that point in time.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't do it. Your reference to the photos in the book, that's a great place. If you think you know Lee Oswald and have not looked at that mix of photos, then you really should kind of restart yourself and go, wait a minute, what's going on here? I hope to do that, just to at least to have it for reference for people that want to take another look, kind of make maybe an open-minded look at Oswald. And I think for my purpose, it's you and I talk context all the time. It's sort of like, what is the context for November 1963?
Right.
Now, what mode was he in? What state was he in? Was he totally dedicated in some sort of a conspiracy, whatever? Was he, or you've got to understand the context before we can understand the conspiracy that really, I'm not abandoning the conspiracy at all.
Right.
Basically, it's kind of interesting at this moment I would disclose, as I always have, I see Oswald as more vulnerable in terms of being set up as a patsy, as being any kind of knowing participant in an action against the president. And vulnerable is probably the key word.
Right.
He had come back. He was extremely frustrated by what had happened to him in the past 60 days. And you can look at his exchanges with Marina and the Paynes and to some extent see how vulnerable he was in terms of being used, as it were.
Absolutely. And I think that not only is context necessary here for this historical character, but a search for continuity, amongst the evidence that is presented, that is preserved, I think is necessary if you want to get an accurate portrait of the man. And I would say that, again, a nod to Bob Grodin's, second big book. He's got three big books, but the second one, which is devoted to Oswald, is a unique resource in that you can have all those things collected together. Now, certainly in the Internet age, you can collect together a lot of photographs all by yourself, so on and so forth. But as a book, as a freestanding something you can hold in your hand and not have to be connected to a Wi-Fi to see this stuff, or have to, you know, spend hours and hours downloading stuff. I mean, there's something like 900 pictures in there. Remarkable the amount of character study one can do through that photographic array that Bob put together there, Robert Groden did. In fact, maybe I should get him back on the show before not too long and maybe discuss just that book. I know he wants to discuss Absolute Proof, and we'll do that too, but I think I'd like to devote a section of that to his book and maybe bring him on the show to revisit it again, because I think it's necessary. And Larry-Hancock.com is where you can go, Larry-Hancock.com. Follow Larry's work, but you think you'll put it out through your website, or you have a place where it'll go eventually, or not yet?
Not really. I want to get it written and kind of peer-reviewed by several people and then decide what to do with it.
Okay.
Because when you're writing about somebody's personality and character, you can't help but insert some of your own, and I've got to make sure it doesn't have too much of my own. So that's why it's going to be more protracted than something that's, oh, just based off the documents.
Right.
It's going to be trying to present him needs some balance to it. And that, of course, got to have the balance checked. But if I get the balance done well enough, shoot, I might convince Rex Bradford to let me put another paper on Mary Farrell.
Well, I look forward to seeing it no matter where it is, because I look forward to just about anything Larry writes. It always is loaded with context and continuity, and I look forward to the three dimensions of Lee Harvey Oswald, or whatever it is the title will be here, because I think we'll get a much more, maybe not totally complete portrait, but a much more reasonable portrait of the historical character that we have all gotten to know in one way or another, to some degree or another, over the years. Larry Hancock was my guest in the second hour, and of course Mike Swanson in the first. And I urge you to go to Larry-Hancock.com. I recommend all of Larry's writing, and I recommend Mike's as well. Anyway, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, remember, I'm merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. And get in touch with me if you want to get involved in that video after 10 p.m. tonight. Thanks a lot, Larry. Thanks, Mike. Good night.